Though initiated by Germany with an unbridled savagery that showed no partiality towards age or innocence, that sought to leave the aggrieved with only their eyes to weep with, the war erupted onto the global stage. Belgium, a neutral territory ostensibly safeguarded by international diplomacy, found itself violated, its integrity marred as German forces surged through its landscape like an uncaring tide. In counteracting this unholy intrusion, a role of indelible valor was enacted by the British Expeditionary Force. Pitted against insurmountable odds, against an enemy that appeared almost mythical in its preparedness, these men and women held their line, echoing through history. This account, a glimpse into the dusk-like early days of a war that would stretch long into an unseeable horizon, is relayed through the experiences of driver George William Blow of the Royal Field Artillery. His is a story marked not merely by the rigors of frontline artillery combat, but by the personal cost, a physique bruised and broken, two ribs shattered, and five loyal horses laid to rest beneath the unforgiving soil. The narrative he weaves is, like the man himself, wounded but unbroken, his voice carrying from the war-torn fields to reach us. A reverberation from a past filled with both heroism and tragedy. Join us now as he describes in his own words the valor, triumph, and heartbreak of those fateful days. This is World War I, The Savage Enemy. And you are listening to The Lore Network.
There, under the scalding sun of that fateful Sunday, Mons became more than just a geographical location. It transformed into a crucible where destinies would be tried and men would be measured. We had settled into camp the previous afternoon, a momentary haven of respite, until 4 in the morning on Sunday. That's when the orders rolled in, cryptic in their urgency, telling us to harness up our horses and steel ourselves for the unknowable. But it wasn't until noon that we were handed our battle orders, a mandate written in the ink of fate. We took our positions in a nearby locale, and before we could acclimate, German shells tore through the skies above us, announcing themselves with explosive ferocity. That was the opening overture of what would evolve into a protracted, horrifying battle, an engagement that would drain both sides of much more than just ammunition. We dove headfirst into the maelstrom, virtually blind. In sharp contrast, our German counterparts had had the luxury of waiting, like spiders in a web, for the entirety of 2 days. Our struggle was primarily against their field artillery. Ominous, but not as cataclysmic as the large siege weapons, the so-called Black Marias, Jack Johnsons, and coal boxes, about which more will be said later. As drivers on horseback, our role was to bring the guns into the arena of conflict, and then retreat to a relative cover with our equine companions. During this strategic withdrawal, bullets from German shells rained down upon us like vengeful hailstones. Meanwhile, farther from our position, our artillerymen and infantry fought tooth and nail in what would become enshrined in history as the Battle of Mons. Our forces were drastically outnumbered from the get-go, yet somehow we held them at bay, subduing their numerical advantage with tenacity and resolve. Soon we were enmeshed in an almost ritualistic rhythm of artillery fire, our guns barking loudly in the searing air. Parallel to us, our infantry acted like grim reapers, cutting down German troops with every sweep of their rifles. Despite our courage and conviction, the enemy fire was relentless. 4 hours into this tempest of violence, we were compelled to retreat. In that decisive moment, we found ourselves the lone battery still functioning within our brigade, a testament to both our endurance and the escalating cost of this dreadful conflict. An officer was dispatched on a reconnaissance mission, his eyes keenly surveying the terrain for a sanctuary where we could regroup. He settled on a modest ravine, carved by torrents of rain, and into this rugged trough we maneuvered our battery with a thunderous urgency. The challenge was not merely the enemy fire, but the treacherous landscape itself, a labyrinth of earth and incline that demanded our utmost attention to prevent the horses from collapsing. Until this moment, our eyes had not met the gaze of German infantry at close range, but as we sank to the ravine's depths, we suddenly found ourselves hemmed in. It was an ambush, masterfully executed. Within its confines, I bore witness to acts of gallantry that will never grace the pages of official records. Corporal Holliday, for instance, braved enemy fire to traverse the ravine twice, alerting us to the perilous fact that we were walking into a premeditated trap. Despite our fervent efforts to break free, the enemy's bullets claimed many of our horses, Oh, it was a terrible sight indeed, as our companions were cut down, their sacrifice ultimately providing some cover to my comrades from the bullets clawing at our lives. Atop my horse, I worked hard to forge ahead amidst the lead and mud that seemed to come from all around me. It was in that tempest of conflict that Destiny's hand intervened, delivering a hard blow to my forehead that threatened to hurl me backwards. My form jarred in the saddle, my back grazing the horse's body beneath. Somehow I held onto the reins as I rose back up into a seated position, the world around me rendered hazy by the formidable impact of a shrapnel shard. My cap had been summarily dispossessed from my brow, leaving a crimson rivulet of blood tracing a perilous course down my furrowed forehead. A close call indeed. Moments later, my loyal companion was cut down from under me and I was flung to the ground. I could do little more than lay flat on my stomach between the fallen bodies of those magnificent warhorses, watching life drain from my own horse's eyes. My hand on its neck providing a final morsel of comfort as he died. I lay there on my stomach in that macabre sanctuary, contemplating my demise for just a moment as bullets and shrapnel tore the world apart around me. I lifted my head just enough to peer over the horse and could make out that the first gun and a pair of wagons had managed to negotiate their way through the gauntlet. Our corporal could have easily joined them, escaping to safety, but he was of a different metal. He came back for us, his voice of encouragement a beacon in the darkness as he shouted over the chaos. His instruction was simple, run for it. His words were a rallying call, snapping me from the haze. I scrambled to my feet, slashing through brambles that clawed at my skin, a thorny baptism under fire. As I burst forth from the foliage, German guns targeted us. Unarmed, save for my whip, my options were limited, so I ran for it in a mad dash for survival. As I ran for my life, my legs, arms, and heart pumped in unison. I half closed my eyes in anticipation of the screaming bullets inevitably striking me in my back. I thought, not for the last time that day, that this was it. This was my end. But it never happened. The bullets never arrived. Instead came the sobering slap of rifle fire from right in front of me. The corporal, in an act of the highest valor, had spun around his rifle, dealing death with resounding authority, dropping three of our assailants, prompting the remaining two to scatter. Without that man's audacious stand, my voice would have been silenced forever. We were pinned in that diabolical ravine for some 5 hours, from the onset of evening until the clock struck 10. No gunners, only drivers. Our confinement was punctuated by the ghastly glow of neighbouring villages, set aflame by the Germans. A hellish scene set against the backdrop of night. Finally, our major made it to a small house, where he met a local woman who assisted us in finding an exit route. During their exchange, the house they stood in became encircled by Germans. The situation was dire, but our major, to the surprise of everyone, utilized his formidable linguistic prowess, dispatched the enemy in fluent German, fooling them by conversing in their mother tongue. His actions not only spared his life, but provided us with the opening to escape. His gallantry, I am told, earned him a recommendation for the Distinguished Service Order. Emerging from that valley felt like resurrection, but our trial was far from over. 2 miles hence, we collided with another detachment of Germans. Yet, by this time, we had been bolstered by reinforcements. Gordon's, Wiltshire, and Sussex men joining the weary procession of retreat. This retreat was a campaign unto itself, fraught with relentless pressure from the Germans, who gave no quarter even to our wounded. When we returned to Mons, the utter shock of the savage nature of our enemies became evident when we came upon a horrific sight. Our wounded comrades who were discovered alone by the enemy were executed, killed not by bullets, but by the brutal crushing of their skulls with the butts of Prussian rifles. And in those harrowing hours of initial confrontation at Mons, our losses had been heavy. Within my battery alone, 12 men and an equal number of horses lay dead, a wagon reduced to splinters. I recount these incidents from the limited purview of my battery and brigade, mere fragments in a larger mosaic of violence and valour. Each brigade comprised 3 batteries of 6 guns, a configuration dwarfed by the enormity of the ordeal we faced. And so I can speak only of my limited slice of that grim world, a chapter in a story too vast for any single participant to narrate in its entirety. In the ebony embrace of a Monday morning, hours past midnight yet shy of dawn, we arrived at our encampment, hearts weighed heavy and muscles worn threadbare from ceaseless skirmishes. We scarcely nurtured the illusion of reprieve. Our hopes of slumber were summarily exiled when the word arrived. At 2 a.m, harness the steeds. At 3, vacate the village. German artillery had set its merciless eye upon us. In the shadowy recesses of this rural hamlet, a makeshift hospital stood. Its inhabitants were our wounded, men whose agonies spoke through their eyes, if not their lips. The Germans, not blind to the Red Cross banners, chose to flay humanity further. They bombarded it, igniting the sanctuary in a pyre of iniquity. My captain and my sergeant had sought respite there. Whether they found escape or perished within those flaming walls remained a mystery. When we lumbered back into the fray, the world was painted in the unforgiving light of day. The theatre of war reopened its curtains, ushering us back onto a stage of peril and pandemonium. We engaged, withdrew, and engaged again, each time at a cost, each time hounded by our relentless adversaries. Our artillery traded roars with German aircraft, steel falcons screeching overhead, marking us for death. Yet field guns were impotent jesters in this skyward theatre. Only howitzers, sculpted for such lofty duels, could send their iron rebukes sky high over winged spies. As Monday bled into Wednesday, we moved from Mons to Cambrai, a disheartening journey inscribed in soil and blood. Here, in this wretched crucible of Cambrai, we were stretched beyond the limits of human endurance. The 6th Battery, having already sacrificed 2 guns and a wagon to the merciless appetite of war at Mons, bled further. Yet we, the 23rd Battery, held our hidden ground. Concealed like phantoms, our guns became harbingers of unseen doom. The Germans, in their blind groping, came close, but never close enough. A divergence of 50 yards in artillery is, as they grimly learned, a chasm between life and annihilation. We rained destruction upon them, justice meted out in iron and fire. Something that weighed heavily on my heart was the sacrifice of the horses, those innocent and loyal beasts entangled in the wars of men. As we rode out of the valley, 2 new horses were brought up to replace those I had lost before. One was a sturdy bay mare with an alert but gentle gaze. The other was a dappled grey gelding, strong and energetic. Each step they took seemed to say that they were up to the challenge, willing to go to the ends of the earth if I asked it of them. My heart soared momentarily, as if their hooves had lifted some of the weight off my soul. I thought, perhaps foolishly, that these noble animals would carry me to the end of this ordeal. But war has no regard for such hopes. We were advancing near Cambrai when it happened. Artillery shells began raining down around us, each explosion an apocalypse of earth, fire, and steel. The air was thick with the smell of cordite, and the ground seemed to shake, as if rebelling against the violence inflicted upon it. Before I could fully comprehend the unfolding chaos, the shriek of incoming shrapnel severed the serenity. With a sound like the tearing of the world itself, mud and metal enveloped us. I felt my baymare shudder violently as she collapsed to the ground, her momentum throwing me off balance and leaving me sprawled on the earth, gasping for air, choking on the smoke and dust. My eyes felt heavy and my head thick with dull throbbing as it tried to cope with the immense pressure of the explosion. When I came to, I was drenched in blood. I rolled over and got to my knees, frantically checking my limbs and searching my chest for the wound. But then I realized that the blood that covered me in a warm, sticky film was not my own. I was drenched in the blood of that heroic horse whose sacrifice had just saved my life. The ringing in my ears silenced the world around me and I could barely see anything, apart from the head of my noble companion severed from her body by the shrapnel that was meant for me. Instinctively, I scrambled to my feet and ran to the 2nd horse. The dappled grey was panicking but still alive, eyes wide in a silent scream. Mounting him in haste, I spurred him to escape the death that seemed to rain from the sky. But as we gained speed, a burst of machine gun fire swept across the field. Bullets zipped through the air like malevolent hornets. 1, 2, 3. They found their mark, and my horse staggered. Each bullet a betrayal of his innocence in this war of men. With a heartbreaking whimper, he fell, his legs giving way beneath him. As he hit the ground, I was thrown once more, tumbling across the broken soil. I scrambled over to him. His eyes met mine, filled with a confusion and pain that cut me to my core. With a last shuddering breath, he stilled. His body relaxed, and I knew he was gone. Once more, I was dismounted, left to join my disheartened comrades on foot. It was a fraternity bonded by loss, and I was its newest member. The weight of it all bore down on me like a mountain. These loyal, innocent creatures, born to fields and pastures, were forced into a hell not of their making and had paid the price for our human follies. Their sacrifice, so unwitting yet so complete, was a crushing testament to the indiscriminate cruelty of war. Garnbre marked the prologue to a shift in fortune. The theatre of conflict moved to the Marne, where battles raged with hellish intensity. After a week of battered retreat, we found ourselves renewed in spirit as we took the offensive. This newfound vigour was galvanised by the desolation we observed. The debris of our own convoys littering the roadways was an acceptable toll of warfare, but the ravages inflicted upon the innocent inflamed our souls. The so-called civilised enemy had wreaked havoc upon families, upon homes, upon hearths. About the cruelty of war and the savagery of man I can bear witness. As we withdrew from Mons, the Belgian and French countryside had been unspoiled canvases of pastoral tranquility. They welcomed us with open arms, nourishing our bodies and spirits. Yet when we traversed those same landscapes anew, what met our eyes was a panorama of devastation and cruelty, an abomination that defied reason and transcended horror. Of this, I shall not speak further. Certain acts illuminate such dark corners of the soul that they defy articulation. As we advanced on the first day, breaching the perimeter of a humble village, my gaze fell upon a most tragic tableau. A young child, seemingly propped against a windowpane, stirred the very soul of a passing infantry officer, Gordon's, if my memory serves correctly. Upon closer inspection, the officer discovered the lifeless form of the child, a wretched casualty of wanton German violence. Compelled, the officer ventured further into this sanctuary-turned slaughterhouse. There he found the mother, her life violently extinguished, her body gruesomely mutilated. The cottage itself lay in ruin, subjected to a maelstrom of senseless destruction. The sight, this monstrous exhibition of human failings, filled our ranks with a kind of madness that even war rarely evokes. Another illustration came 2 hours behind the footprints of marauding Uhlans. These are men who exhibit their martial prowess in the face of the elderly, of women, of children. Yet they flee in ignominy before the hooves of British cavalry. We found a farmhouse, once the sanctuary of an elderly couple who had eked out an existence from the land they cherished. The wife remained. Her husband had been dragged out into a field and executed. Their humble home was ransacked, its hearth emptied of warmth and life. Our men, moved by her desolation, offered their morning rations of bully beef and biscuits, a nourishment more sorely needed by their own bodies. The stories unfolded in succession as we moved through the ravaged landscape. Tales of intimidation and theft, of German soldiers brandishing revolvers at terrified women, extorting from them the last vestiges of material security. Such narratives infused our cause with a fiercer righteousness. We were not merely reclaiming territory, we were exorcising a wicked presence. At 7 o'clock that fateful morning, we took our positions. Across open fields and rugged terrains we moved, undeterred by the constant barrage of German shells. These projectiles seemed to lack the prescience to locate our 12 operational batteries, fortresses of artillery that meted out punishment with a zeal matched only by our own disdain for the enemy. We held ground until 8, then resumed our relentless advance. The Germans, once set upon a path of retreat, revealed an extraordinary affinity for speed, especially when spurred by the bayonets and bullets of our indomitable infantry. As we approached the Marne, the theatre of war escalated in both scope and cruelty. Now we were introduced to the more formidable armaments in the German arsenal. What we colloquially dubbed Black Marias, coal boxes, and Jack Johnsons. These beasts disgorged 90-pound shells, shrouding the landscape in noxious, greasy clouds, a fog of death. The Battle of the Marne was an expansive and protracted affair, stretching over 3 harrowing weeks. Even our ambulance wagons, vehicles of mercy in this merciless landscape, were subjected to the savagery of German siege guns, systematically blasted into oblivion. No stratagem seemed too cruel, no act too contemptible for our foes. They exploited the Red Cross itself, stowing machine guns in ambulance wagons, an affront to every code of honour and conduct. The battle among the infantry on both sides can only be described as savage. The very posture of our men, declaring that there would be a reckoning for German aggression. Countless times the Germans attacked, attempting to pierce our lines. Our men fought like demons, caked in mud and drenched in sweat. Blood and adrenaline, they repelled these incursions with a fervor that can only be described as divine. In the heart of that hellish theater, men from both sides locked eyes with the enemy, their expressions a mirror of determination and tenacity. With anguished cries, the fight unfolded. Bayonets seeking flesh, bullets tearing through the shroud of acrid smoke. The visceral brutality of close combat knew no bounds. As men grappled and brawled, each movement a struggle for life amidst the stench of blood and battle. Frenzied skirmishes and thunderous clashes of steel, the screams of the wounded, and the shouts of our commanders blended into this storm of violence. As the field turned crimson with spilled blood, the line of British soldiers began to exert dominance. The Germans, unyielding but battered, began to falter in the face of our unbroken spirit and resolve. In the fading twilight, it was the tattered and mud-smeared forms of our infantrymen that stood victorious, their trusted rifles smouldering, their blood-drenched bayonets glistening. A picture that was the embodiment of unwavering courage. During that relentless month of fighting that carried us across the fields of France and Belgium, we even found ourselves treading on the historic terrain of Waterloo. The distant monument dedicated to that long-ago battle served as a reminder of battles won and lost. Perhaps the Germans fancied a poetic victory over us at this site, but their aspirations dissolved into the mist. We continued to push them back, exacting a heavy toll for their aggression. During one intense battle, I rose to behold a horrifying sight. Our position had been flanked by a detachment of German infantry. Their ferocious battle cry chilled me to my core as they projected unrestrained viciousness and savagery. The air was electric with tension, our position dangerously exposed on a slight rise that offered little in the way of cover. We knew the Germans had us outnumbered, and my eyes were fixed on the detachment of about 200 enemy soldiers preparing to charge on our position. They were going to butcher us. Their bayonets glinted menacingly in the intermittent sunlight that broke through the thick clouds overhead. But standing between us and an assuredly grim fate were only 20 of our Gordons, men whose reputation for fearlessness and skill was beyond reproach. Outnumbered they stood, 20 against 200, yet their posture spoke a different story. "Come and get it," their presence cried, as if they had been eagerly awaiting this very moment that now hung suspended, as if time itself hesitated, reluctant to unleash the ensuing brutality. And then, the German troops rushed forward, a human wave intent on sweeping us away. But our Gordons, these titans among men, took their stand. They raised their rifles in almost sacred synchrony and aimed with a calm that belied the chaos surrounding them. As their fingers caressed the triggers, a guttural battle cry erupted from their chests, a bone-chilling shout that echoed through the field and seemed to penetrate the very heavens. The rifles barked, a series of sharp cracks that sounded like the world breaking. One by one, German soldiers tumbled forward onto the ground, their final steps leaving them sprawled in the dirt like discarded marionettes. Those who survived the initial volley faltered, their courage draining from their faces as they caught sight of the Gordons, now drawing bayonets with an audible rasp of steel against scabbard. And then the Gordons charged. I'm unashamed to report to you the tears of pride and respect that freely ran down my face as I witnessed that charge. Such valor. It was not just a charge. It was the amalgamation of divine steel and flesh and pure, unyielding will. They collided with the enemy, bayonets thrusting, slashing, finding the gaps in armor and the soft flesh beneath. Each thrust was not just an attack, but an affirmation of defiance, a primal scream rendered in steel and blood. The hand-to-hand combat was not just fighting, it was primal in nature. Each movement a lethal choreography honed through training and sharpened by adrenaline. The Germans, already unnerved, could not stand against this ferocious spectacle. Their eyes, wide with the gut-wrenching fear of predators turned prey, met the steely gazes of those magnificent Gordons. And in that moment, they broke. As if some unspoken signal passed among them, they turned, their courage shattered, and fled back down the hill. Those who turned to run found no respite. our Gordons chased them with the same unyielding resolve, their bayonets thirsty for justice, remembering the villages and civilian atrocities witnessed in the weeks that led up to this very moment. The field was soon cleared, the immediate threat vanquished, but the air remained thick with the acrid smell of gunpowder and the metallic tang of blood. It was an almost unbelievable scene, an uncanny inversion of the laws of probability and warfare, but I had seen it unfold before my eyes. Just 20 men, now drenched in the blood of their enemies, fueled by courage and skill, had turned the tide and sent an enemy 10 times their number fleeing in abject terror. The power of their valor was a flame that seared itself into my memory, a light that would guide us through the dark days ahead. The physical fighting was only part of the trial at the Battle of the Marne. The conditions were grueling. Wet weather soaked us to the bone, offering no respite for nearly 3 weeks. We were in perpetual motion, so much so that taking off our boots seemed a luxury we could ill afford. Heartbreakingly, the horses too suffered immensely, going days without proper food and rest. There were moments during our strategic withdrawals when we had a mere 2 hours of rest over a 4-day period. We couldn't afford the luxury of halting our march. The enemy was relentless, pursuing us in motor lorries filled with soldiers. But when our artillery could unleash its full fury, especially during rapid gunfire, the devastation we wreaked upon them was monumental. In one such instance, I estimate our battery fired close to 1,000 rounds in a single day, creating hell on earth for the enemy. In the trenches and fields of Marne, amid the chaos of exploding shells and the acrid stench of gunpowder, I found an unlikely friend, a new horse, a magnificent chestnut mare with a blaze down her nose and eyes that held an old, wise kindness. Perhaps it was the trauma of war, but she struck a chord deep inside me. Over the weeks, she became more than just a mount. She was my companion, my confidant, a shred of peace in a world unraveling at the seams. Every gallop under the rain of bullets, every charge through the haze of artillery fire seemed to forge an unspoken bond between us. When night fell and the world quieted just a little, I would sit beside her, stroking her mane and sharing whatever I had from my scant rations. She would nuzzle against me, her warm breath a small comfort in those nights. What was it about camaraderie between man and beast? For in those moments, it was as if the war receded, reduced to an abstract backdrop against the tangible reality of our friendship. We fought side by side for nearly 3 weeks, and she carried me as if she understood the sacredness of our shared mission, as if she knew that each battle could be our last. Then came that fateful morning, a dawn like any other, drenched in the promise of unspoken peril. Our artillery thundered, and we moved forward, hooves pounding the earth in a frenzied drumbeat that drowned out the roaring cannons. Without warning, a shrieking shell from the enemy lines arced through the sky, its trajectory a streak of malice aimed at our advancing line. Time seemed to slow as it descended, and in that elongated moment, I felt her tense beneath me. The shell found its mark. An explosion erupted around us, a cataclysm of fire and shrapnel. She cried out, a heart-wrenching, piercing sound that seemed to cleave my soul, as her body absorbed the lethal impact, shielding me from certain death. The force of the explosion threw us both into the air, tumbling in a disorienting tangle of man and beast. I hit the ground with a bone-jarring thud, and before I could react, she fell beside me, her body trapping me in a ditch. I was pinned, immobile, as bullets screamed overhead and artillery pounded the earth around me. Each breath became an exercise in agony. I could feel the stab of broken ribs with every inhale and my consciousness blurring at the edges. I could feel her breathing become heavy and slow. We were both dying. It was there that I was eventually found, pulled from the cruel embrace of that muddy ditch, but leaving behind my brave, beautiful companion who had succumbed to her injuries. Her sacrifice meant that I would live, even as she lay still and cold, her eyes forever fixed in that final terrible moment. Evacuated and sent to a hospital in London, I would survive my physical wounds, but the injury to my spirit felt far less certain. In the sterile white room, the antiseptic smell could not cleanse the scent of war from my nostrils, nor could the soft sheets erase the memories etched into my soul. And as I lay there, trying to mend, my thoughts kept drifting back to that field in Marne, to the ditch where I left a part of myself and the horse who had given her life so that I might keep mine. I wept, for her, for me, for all of us entangled in this senseless, endless tragedy. The mementos of that period are scant but poignant, a piece of a heavy Uhlan saddle and my own blood-stained khaki jacket. Now, as I prepare to visit the doctor, I look ahead to a future filled with life-altering events, a wedding, a return to the front, and beyond that, who knows? Despite a month of continuous battle, a body weary and bruised and a spirit tested in unimaginable ways, I find myself resilient and ready for the next chapter, whatever it may hold. Driver George William Blow of the Royal Field Artillery.
This was World War I, The Savage Enemy, and you are listening to The Law Network. Join us again as we meet other soldiers and listen as they describe in their own words the valor, triumph, and heartbreak of war.